Hey, thanks for showing up. I'm Lisa Whittle, and welcome to the Jesus Over Everything show, affectionately known as Joe, where this season it's all about truth-telling, finding the good, and showing up for our lives today, no matter what has happened, even yesterday. There are certain people I have incredible respect for as a writer, but also a person. Dr. Alicia Brett Cole fits into that space. Her writing is not only deep and thorough, but thoughtful and full of Jesus. She was on my short list of people I've been wanting to talk to for a long time, and when I actually got to do it, it was a better conversation than I even hoped. You will be deeply and profoundly moved by this conversation. You're going to walk away with at least one thing you won't soon forget. We talked doubt, deconstructionism, habits of a truly healthy soul, women leading and teaching, and how we trust the church again after spiritual authority and abuse. This was full of the tough conversations the church needs to be having, and I'm so honored I got to have so many of them with the tender, brilliant, and deeply in love with Jesus, Dr. Alicia Brett Cole. So I want you to know I come into this conversation with really deep admiration for you. I was going to say that I'm a fan, but I honestly feel like that waters down the way I actually feel about your work and such. I don't love the word fan. So I was trying to remember the first book of yours I read. It may have been Anonymous, but I feel like there was maybe one before that. Your books are so intentional. They're so deep and important. How do you choose the books you write? What is your process? Or is it like me where I feel like they almost choose me?
That's probably a little bit closer for me too, Lisa. I liken writing to dancing, like a dance with God. It's like the music begins and he leads and I follow. And writing for me is this beautiful devotional experience. So I wait for the music to begin. And sometimes that begins by something burning in my soul. Sometimes that begins by God inspiring somebody else to ask me, you know, to open a door. But it's the music and the following that makes writing just so good for my soul, regardless of how it's received. There's something in the process that is nourishes my love for Jesus and my awareness of his love for me.
I absolutely feel that. I know exactly what you're talking about. And I know a little bit about your background, but remind listeners, if they're not as familiar, I mean, your relationship with Jesus was not maybe the same as how you came to your relationship with Jesus, not actually the same as maybe somebody who grew up in the church or something along those lines. And I think it's reflected in your writing with the depth that you show. I know that's a big, you know, a big question, like, tell me about your background. So I'm not asking you to tell me all of the years of your life, but particularly that piece of like how you came to know this Jesus that you love so much.
Yes. Oh, gladly share that story. I was an atheist, a sincere and certain atheist. And in the beginning, Lisa, I wasn't angry. I wasn't argumentative. I didn't choose atheism because I was disappointed in the church or someone had hurt me. I came to atheism philosophically. It just seemed to me the most reasonable choice given what could be known and what could never be known. And so to me, I truly believed that God hadn't created humankind, that humankind had created God, because there were just so many questions in life that were never going to be answered by science or reason or even experience. So for me, atheism was a reflection of being a realist.
Yeah.
And then as my life began to be more seasoned by pain, that's when some anger started gathering around the edges of my atheism. And that's when I began arguing with others and just being annoyed with anyone, you know, be they a Christian or a Hindu or anybody who would state that there was a God or there were gods that held power. Because when I took a realistic look around the world, it sure seemed that if there was a higher power, that higher power wasn't using their power to prevent pain.
Yeah.
So the atheism just continued to cement and grow. And then there were two surprising gifts that God gave me, Lisa. One was the friendship of two unsuspecting young women who had a sincere love for Jesus, but who had never, ever, ever had anyone question their faith. They decided they were going to befriend an atheist, and oh my word, almost all of our conversations would end in their tears. And then out of their tears, they would say one of the wisest things they could have said. They said, "I don't know an answer to your question." And as a sidebar, "I don't know" is a really smart answer when it's true. "I don't know" is very confidence producing when wow. it's sincere. So they would say through their tears, "I don't know an answer to your question, but I do know that Jesus lives, and I do know that he loves you." And I just kept dismissing them. I just dismissed them as people who preferred fairy tales over the harshness of reality. But their love and their presence and Christ within them began this thaw inside of me that they couldn't see and I couldn't perceive, but it was actual. So first God gifted me with two young women who were just determined to be my friends. And then there was a very persistent friend who kept inviting me to church over and over and over and over and over. And I finally realized that she was never going to stop, Lisa. Like, for the rest of my life, she was going to find me on Saturday morning and just call me and say, "You got to go." So finally I told her, I said, "Listen, I'll go once if you never ask me again." And she said, "Deal." And so I walked with her. I was actually visiting her and her daughter in another state. And I walked with her into this itty bitty little church filled with a bunch of sincere senior saints. I'm going to say the average age in the house was around 92. Oh. And I was expecting absolutely nothing. I was sitting in the back row, wasn't drunk, wasn't high, wasn't in the pit of despair. I wasn't there to find a God because I sincerely believed that a God did not exist. I was there to get rid of a Christian, and this seemed the shortest route. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
And these brokenhearted, dear elderly saints began to sing, and that was it for me, Lisa. The atheist in the back row had an hour and a half long encounter with the God who pursues even those who deny him, and it felt like waters opened up above me, surged through me. I was fully present, you know, to everything that was happening, but I was no longer alone. And in the middle of that experience, I knew that I had been wrong. I knew that there was a God. And though I'd studied different world religions and would have been intellectually open to any name, there was one name that sounded, and it was the name of Jesus. And I just remember thinking, "Oh my word, this changes everything. It has to. And I'm not even sure what the question is, Jesus, but if you want me, my answer is yes."
Wow.
And I began new life in that itty bitty little church.
Oh my goodness. There are so many things that, wow. First of all, that is a beautiful story. That is a gorgeous story. I am so grateful that you shared that. Thank you so much. And you know, I have so many thoughts. One of which is, you know, the two groups of people that the Lord used to bring you to him are two of the groups that are often dismissed. One being youth, the second being elderly. And so it strikes me, you know, as we have listeners that maybe feel like, "Oh, I'm too young. I can't make an impression. What do I have to offer?" You know, so my first thought is, for those of you who think I'm too young, these two young women were such a pivotal part of your story. And then for those who think I'm too old, what do I have to offer at this point? It was those that were more seasoned in life that also helped that thaw, as you call it, which I mean, I love how you termed that, the thaw. And just also the beauty of someone being persistent in inviting you to church, because I think sometimes we feel like, "I don't want to be a pest. I don't want to pursue in that way because no one wants that invitation anymore." And it's simply not true. And we just don't know. We just don't know. And our call is to be obedient to the Lord, to do whatever he asks us to do. And what a story. Oh my goodness. Thank you so much for sharing that. Goodness gracious. Now I can better understand where the depth of your writing comes from. One of your books I love so much is your book on Lent. I've gone through it myself, the 40 Days of Decrease. You wrote this back in 2016, I think, wasn't it? Honestly, before Lent became maybe a more popular topic among a lot of Christians, at least maybe more widespread in certain denominations. Why write about Lent?
Yes, you know, the book on Lent is really the overflow of a very long-term study. I think it was back in around 1994, Lisa, that I started studying spiritual pain and the place of loss and less in the life of faith. It just has been a topic, I think, having been an atheist, leaning realist, realizing that optimism is not a synonym for faith, that these kind of themes have always been of interest to me. And so when I was doing my doctoral dissertation, it was on disillusionment as the unexpected friend of spiritual formation. And it was just fascinating because we tend to think in a life of faith that we always need to be increasing, constantly increasing, that everything is more and everything is better. And we speak in superlatives, but God is with us in every single moment. His presence is what makes every single moment rich with potential. And so that means that the valleys as well as the mountains have the exact same richness to them. They're flavored with the same presence of God. You know, whether we are lost in worship in a community service or we're weeping in isolation in some room somewhere, the same presence of God is with us. Our shouts don't thicken him. Yes. And our doubts don't thin him. Mm. And so when I was thinking of a practical application of this emphasis on, and my doctoral emphasis on disillusionment, I thought, you know, why don't we reacquaint ourselves with Lent? Because what Lent really is this slow journey with Jesus and with the disciples through what had to have been some of the most disillusioning days of the disciples' life.
Yeah.
And we rush through them to get to the resurrection on the other side, but there's so much to lean into in that slow walk to and through the cross. So it was that partnership with a long-term theme that has captivated my heart and a desire to make an actual practical application and offering to those in my generation.
It is a good offering. And I'm telling you, I loved going through the study. I thought it was so powerful and practical. And I love that combination. Even what you're saying here is just, oh, it's stirring. It's stirring. Thank you for that offering. In this season of life, what does the word home mean to you?
Oh, wow. That's a great question, Lisa. You know, I feel that I carry home with me. I've been sinking deeply even just this last week, just literally this last week, into, oh my goodness, where's the verse, Lisa? It's John 14. Is it John 14, 23? Where Jesus says, if you love me, you'll obey me and my Father, and I will come and make our home with you. And I was growing up, Lisa, I moved every year of my life, literally. The first time I ever lived more than 1 year anywhere was my junior and senior year in high school. And so when I went to the University of Texas in Austin for 4 years, I mean, wow, I was like a, you know, long-termer in Austin as far as I was concerned. And so home was always relational for me growing up, even as an atheist. Home was where mom and dad were, because we always were either, you know, unpacking boxes or repacking boxes moving every year.
Right.
And I think that, you know, when Jesus interrupted my atheistic existence, a home, to realize that home, that I was at home because Jesus was with me.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. I mean, for someone who didn't have that sense of rooting any geographic location, in any geography, any kind of, you know, location or zip code. Jesus's home was extraordinary. So home is where my family is. And on a deeper level, home is within, as Jesus has taken up residence in my heart.
So good. I relate. You also hold a doctorate, as we mentioned, in leadership and spiritual formation. A lot of folks, you know, in some type of leadership listen to this podcast, and we all follow leaders in some way. And I think we all kind of lead in some way as well. I have some thoughts on that. Is there a quality good leaders share that you've seen through the years, that you've witnessed, that you've been around, that we can either look for in leaders we follow or that we seek to be if we're in leadership ourselves? Is there sort of one quality that you've seen that you've been like, yeah, that's a really good quality for a leader to have?
Gosh, another great question. I think that the word that comes to my mind is, well, love. I think that when a leader leads from knowing that they're loved, so when I say love, I'm not even talking right now about their ability to love others. I'm talking about their confidence, deep internal confidence, that they are loved. If I lead as someone who is beloved, I lead differently because I'm not leading to gain anything. I'm not leading to increase my value. When you lead because you know that you're loved, your leadership, I think, has fewer strings attached. It has less of an opportunity to become abusive, frankly.
Wow.
Because you're leading from a place of knowing deeply that you're loved. And conversely, that's one of the greatest challenges and some of the greatest cleanup we have in the church.
Right.
Some people have the skills to lead, the gifts to lead, even the experience to lead, but they didn't know that they were deeply loved.
You would have no way of knowing this. Zero. You would literally no way of knowing this, but one of the things I write about in my next book, oh gosh, I'm emotional about this. You know, my father was a mega church pastor and he resigned his church over a lack of a better word, scandal, back in the 90s. And of course it affected me as a young woman and all of these things. But one of the things that the Lord showed me, even as a young woman, first time I write about this in this new book, was this, that my father preached to thousands and he preached about the love of God, but I knew that he never really knew that he was loved himself. And so the fact that you just said that is so interesting because I watched that, I witnessed that in a leader who otherwise was so capable, was so charismatic, was a wordsmith, an incredible orator. I mean, he was all of these things, but he wrestled with believing that he was loved. He was wrought by a lot of shame and guilt over things from his past. And it affected his leadership in such a profound way. And I have never heard another person articulate what you just said. And you would have no way of knowing that I just wrote that, but it affected everything in his leadership and it affected how he allowed God to deal with him. And as a result, we moved all over the United States because, you know, in many ways, he was looking for something that a zip code couldn't fix, but it felt, I think, to him at the time as the solution, you know? So let's move. God's calling us away. And so we all did that dutifully. But it was that piece. It was that piece there that was missing that he never really felt loved because he, for one reason or another, but I always wished that for him, even as a young woman. I mean, what do I know at 21? But I knew that my dad didn't really know how much God loved him. And that's an interesting thing that you just said, and it's so very true. I watched it myself. Here's what your bio says. It says this: she loves to study and teach less than trendy themes. I love that. I smiled so big when I read that. I was like, yes, I love that. You're not trendy. You're amazing. Like what grows in barren seasons, the discipline of decrease. We've talked about that with your Lent study, the use and abuse of spiritual authority, doubt as a growing pain of faith, and habits of a truly healthy soul. So these are hefty topics, and yet these are the things we need to be talking about in that next book that I'm referring to. It's called The Hard Good. I have a chapter on facing uncomfortable truth and hard conversations. The Hard Good itself is about good coming from the difficult only through the Lord. In many ways, it is about decrease. So I want to ask you about a few of these things that you have mentioned here on your own bio. So let's dive into them. Doubt. If someone was going through a season of doubt right now that is listening, what is your encouragement for them? Because I believe there's a difference between doubt and wrestling and questioning absolutely everything in sort of that dangerous deconstructionism, which is different in my mind. Yeah.
I agree. Yes, I view doubt as a growing pain of faith. Doubt is, it's an expression of honesty. And I think that honesty is a friend of intimacy with God. So if we have questions, being honest about them is one of the healthiest things we can do for our souls. But we have to be honest with God. And so if we think of ourselves in a posture, we have this posture of honesty towards God. Think of facing him, kind of like Mary and Martha did after Lazarus died. And they both came to Jesus in turn and said, if you'd been here, my brother wouldn't have died. They faced him with their questions. I mean, if I were to paraphrase, I think they were saying, I'm sorry, where were you? But they faced him with their questions. They faced him with their pain, with their spiritual disappointment. Right. And that was honest. Illusions, deception, denial, they have no healing power. They can never, they will never heal. So we have to bring emotional honesty into our understanding of spiritual health. We face God with our questions. We process the pain with him. And so, you know, to those who have doubts and to those who have questions, I offer an encouragement that God isn't nervous. He's really rather secure. Yeah. He can handle anything. He has anticipated everything. But we do have a responsibility to express what we're feeling honestly, but face to face with him. And I think that's the safe place to process questions and doubt in the life of faith.
Yes, so true. Good. Okay, habits of a truly healthy soul. Tell me what those are.
Yes. Well, I think that we need to reclaim our definition of health. You know, health is not, when we think spiritually, when we think in terms of our soul, health is not the ability to somehow turn back the clock and look younger. A healthy soul is a soul that's preparing itself for Jesus. A healthy soul is one that's thinking with God, that is thinking every moment with God, that is living with God. A healthy soul is one that realizes that our life is a gift, but our life is also God's art. And we just need to take care of God's art. It's a way of saying thank you to the giver. One of the illustrations I often use, Lisa, is, you know, if we were blessed with just a whole chunk of change and we had the opportunity to buy two families a car. So we give Joe's family a car and we give Jerry's family a car and they're thrilled and they're happy about it. And later on we go and we just happen to visit them. And so, you know, we're visiting Joe and we of course walk by his driveway, the car's there. And we just happen to notice, you know, the car's in pretty good shape. It's had normal wear and tear. It's got some French fries in the back seat, but it's been taken care of. And, you know, then we go later on that afternoon, we visit Jerry. Car's in the driveway, but I tell you, the car is just a wreck. I mean, it not just normal wear and tear. This is this is disastrous. This hasn't been maintained. It hasn't been taken care of. Now, the gift is irrevocable, right? We're not going to ask anybody for the keys. But without Joe or Jerry saying a thing, whom would we feel more gratitude from? Mm. And so your life, your entire life, your body, your mind, your heart, your life is a gift from God. And taking care of it is one of the ways we can say thank you to the gift giver. And so that removes a concept like soul care out of the realm of just a spiritualized form of narcissism. It makes soul care. Now it's in the realm of gratitude.
Yes.
And now it's in the realm of intimacy with God. And when I think of a healthy soul, that is how I try to frame things, because I do believe we're God's art. And if we believed that, we would not only live differently personally, we would treat one another differently relationally.
Goodness gracious. Yes, that's some wisdom. So, so good. Okay, here's a doozy, but we've got to attack it. Spiritual authority and abuse. How do we trust the church again after this? Now, I'm coming from perspective of someone who loves the church, who has a lifelong relationship with the church. So this isn't a question to bash the church in any way. I know that it's really tough, though, and we have to face the uncomfortable conversation, the hard conversation about it. It's hard for folks to trust spiritual authority, church, when a lot of abuses have been perpetrated in those spaces.
Yes. Yes, it is. I think we can broaden the conversation to trust is a challenge for humanity. And so what do we have in the church? We have a collection of people who have acknowledged that they're sinners.
Yes.
We have a collection of people who know that they're in need of a savior. But this still isn't Eden.
Right.
And I think that's part of the challenge sometimes of what we think when we think about faith and we think about Christianity. And I'm especially concerned about what kind of expectations we're passing on to the next generation, Lisa. But
yes.
We do seem to expect Garden of Eden Christianity and a Garden of Gethsemane age.
Mm.
It isn't Eden anymore, but it won't always be Gethsemane. Mm. And so I think that if we work on our expectations a little bit more upfront, if leaders perhaps lead with more vulnerability and less concern that what is real will empty their authority. That just perhaps that a more accurate sense of expectation will protect us a bit from unnecessary disappointment. There's going to be disappointment, period. We are humans. Humans together guarantee pain, period. But if as sinners we are all facing Jesus together, we're following him together, if we understand that we bring all our stuff with us. I mean, who was it? I have no idea who to even quote that said, you know, when you bring all the animals into the barn, they bring their stuff with them. So perhaps some of the conversations that we need to have is, since we are still humans in process, sinners together, acknowledging that as a community of faith, how do we then interact with one another in a way that's less abusive, you know, that's less wrought with, I don't want to say power grabs, but value grabs. I think that part of the answer deals with our expectation. And can I hope this isn't too far off track, but Lisa, I feel like we have lost the sense of sacredness over dark nights of the soul. That just, you know, over, and I don't know when it happened. I really don't. I don't know when it happened, but I think somewhere along the line, we began thinking that if we just did this Christian thing right, we'd somehow be able to miss those dark nights.
Yeah.
But, you know, just get our ducks in a row, get our dominoes lined up. So much so, we believe that so much that when people do go through struggles that leaders aren't allowed to talk about, but we'd be so much healthier if they could.
Yes.
You know, the sadness, the despair, the depression.
Yeah.
The anxiety, the difficulty in leading, the sense that you can't win for losing, the blue Mondays. When people do go through those, not only are they not allowed to talk about it, if they do even whisper about it, they're accused of having done something wrong. I mean, mm-hmm. It's like we've become Job's comforters.
Yeah.
You know, hey, Job, summer's a reward, winter's a punishment. You're in winter. What did you do wrong? No. God made both summer and winter. He is Lord over all the seasons. And so I feel like it's almost like this ball of yarn, but there's a lot of different strings to pull to try to make it more livable.
Yes. It's a big conversation. And of course, you know, it could be a whole show. There are a lot of arms to it. There are a lot of things here at play. I think one of the things that what you're talking about that's really crucial is there is a secrecy culture to a degree here. And a lot of it is because of some of it certainly is just a lack of integrity on the part of a leader. I will absolutely say that 100%. I think a lot of it too is there is a heavy expectation put on leaders that they cannot be, that we cannot be human. And that's dangerous territory for anybody to be put on such a higher pedestal, because we are all human and there is no supernatural, there is no supernatural besides the Lord. And we are all fallible people and we are all capable of sin, all manner of sin. And so, you know, I think the conversation really dips into celebrity culture, and it dips into expectation, and it dips into everybody's secret life. All of us have one, that only the Lord knows, and, are the ways that we look at sin and the degrees that we put on them versus how the Lord views sin. I mean, really the conversation is so, so layered, but I think what we're talking about here in this moment is, you know, really understanding the humanness of people and also, trusting the Lord versus trusting, even ourselves to a great degree, you know. And I think we, you know, in this culture, we just really honor, hey, believe in yourself. And I think that's a dangerous thing to do. And I also want us to have hard conversations, because honestly, we need to be talking about things. Leadership for too long has been about Christian leadership. Spiritual leadership has been about you need to keep that secret. You need to keep that struggle private. If that's something that you're doing, you just need to kind of deal with it, soldier through. And I think what's happened is we're seeing the result of a lot of that now. We're seeing all of those, you know, those facades crumble and those secret places come out. And see, those secret places do need to come out. I don't suggest we keep them in a closet. What I say is, boy, I wish we didn't have a need for those secret places. And that's what you said too, that we could feel like we could have these conversations and say, listen, I struggle with my thought life, or I'm struggling with this or that, or, you know, even my marriage or relationship, because that's all very real for a leader too, you know? Yeah, it really is. So thank you for answering that and tackling that with me, because it's hard. There's a lot more to talk about than just on this, you know, in 5 minutes on a show.
Yeah. Well, and Lisa, too, I feel like this generation coming up is even more vulnerable, because they not only inherit this sort of superstar myth of an influencer, but they also have been encouraged to substitute experience for intimacy. Oh, I'm so concerned about that combination, my friend.
I
feel like we have a lot of work to do, because they have so much potential, but with those two misthinks carrying them in, I'm deeply concerned for how quickly they could be sidelined by just by pain, and by dry seasons, and by the kind of things that, you know, ancient saints will say are the stuff that made them people who had an offering that would endure. So I think we have a good bit of work to do.
You're exactly right. Wow. All right, friend. These are going to be just a few quick questions. The first thing that comes to the top of your mind, and we'll just zip through them. This is coming from your perspective, obviously, not mine. The thing I love about life right now is?
Family.
A writer that compels me is?
Oswald Chambers.
Good one. A way I stay spiritually alive is?
The practice of silence.
Here's my last question, and I ask it of every single guest. What is the last thing you would say about Jesus if you could only say one more thing?
That he calls you beloved.
This has been this has been a life-giving conversation. The way that I feel about it is this. I am better for the last 35 minutes spent in conversation with you. So thank you for leaving me better than the way that I came into this. I really mean that.
Lisa, thank you. It's been such a joy and honor, and I hope one day we could just sit down and have some tea or coffee. I'd love to get to know you better.
I believe that's going to happen. Me too. Thank you.
Absolutely.
Thanks for listening to Jesus Over Everything with Lisa Whittle. Has your life gotten complicated? Would you like to know how to uncomplicate it in the day-to-day? My book, Jesus Over Everything, helps you do just that. It's available wherever books are sold. So grab a copy of the book that is changing people's lives.